from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Recovery efforts continued late Tuesday after confirmation that a missing Air Asia Airbus A320-200 carrying 162 people had been found off the coast of Borneo earlier in the day. Rescue teams with Indonesia's Navy found bodies and debris from the plane that went missing Sunday. As of late Tuesday, more than 40 bodies had been recovered, according to the Indonesian officials. Objects resembling parts of the plane, as well as what was thought to be the plane's outline underwater, were seen in the search area. It remained unknown as of press time what caused the plane, AirAsia Flight 8501, to plunge into the sea in poor weather on Sunday, less than an hour after taking off from the Indonesian city of Surabaya, bound for Singapore. The depth of the water where the debris was found is between 25 and 30 meters. Divers will be used in the recovery operation, according to Indonesian search and rescue agency Basarnas. But Indonesian officials expressed concern over the currents in the sea, saying if the bad weather persists, the debris could be spread before the crews can get to it. Aside from the Indonesian military, rescuers from Singapore, Malaysia, and Australia were taking part. Thailand planned to join the search, and the U.S. had reportedly sent a warship to assist. The U.N. Security Council was set late Tuesday to hear a presentation of a draft resolution calling for the recognition of the state of Palestine. We have this report from Press TV.
The Palestinian envoy to the United Nations has presented to the Security Council a draft resolution calling for the recognition of the state of Palestine.
We've discussed several issues concerning the amendments they will be that Palestine has recommended. After putting the resolution in blue, they will be introduced and amended today. They concern different issues. Perhaps, Riyad, you want to talk about them, but I will mention there's the issue of Jerusalem. There are other issues concerning the prisoners, water, settlements, and the illegitimate wall that was condemned by the International Court. And we've also recommended that both our leadership will be discussing together to find the best way and the best timing to vote in the Security Council the resolution that will be amended today.
The draft, which also calls for an end to the Israeli occupation of Palestine, will be put to vote on Tuesday. The resolution submitted by Jordan earlier this month was unanimously endorsed by Arab ambassadors. The draft contains new provisions on declaring East Jerusalem al-Quds as the capital of a Palestinian state, settling the issue of Palestinian prisoners, and halting Israeli settlements. The resolution needs 9 yes votes in the Security Council to get it passed. The United States has, however, rejected the text that will pave the way to a Palestinian state by setting a 12-month deadline to reach a final peace deal. Washington is highly believed to use its veto power against the move. Joining us now from Berkeley via Skype is Henry Noor. He's an activist and political commentator. Now, first of all, what do you make of the speed at which this revised draft resolution has made its way to the UN Security Council?
Well, I'm pretty suspicious about the speed of it because, you know, the composition of the Security Council changes in 2 days. After January 1st, there'll be new membership. I think what's really happening, I'm not sure about this, but my suspicion is that what's happening is that the Palestinians are rushing it through to get the vote taken this year because the Palestinian Authority is rushing it through because they know they don't have the votes, and therefore the U.S. won't have to cast a veto. If they were to wait till next year, they have a better chance because when the composition changes, several countries, Australia, South Korea, Rwanda, that are in the pocket of the Americans, will be leaving, and so the new composition includes Malaysia, Venezuela, several other countries where there's a better chance of getting the votes. And they might actually get the 9 votes required and then at least force the Americans to use their veto, which would be embarrassing to the Americans and probably cause the Americans to punish the PA leadership. So I think what's really going on with this push after all these years, suddenly trying to push it through this week, I think is really a roundabout favor to the Americans.
Right, but then is it even a prudent course of action? Because a lot of it is still left to chance, in the sense that the decision of the refugee status of the Palestinians that are living outside of Palestine, the borders, all this still need to be hammered out even after this resolution gets accepted.
Well, of course. And in fact, the resolution is not going to solve anything. Even if it were to pass, it wouldn't solve anything at all. The Israelis have rejected it, the Americans rejected it, and so on. And so, you know, it's all, I think the way to look at it is that it's part of a political process. It's part of a world maneuvering using this the widespread support for the Palestinian cause on the part of world opinion to put some pressure on the Americans and the Israelis. It doesn't solve it. And in particular, I think that, you know, it definitely looks like it wouldn't do anything for the refugees. It has all the strengths, if you want to say, and also the demerits of a two-state solution, which basically involves leaving the refugees out in the cold. But in any case, it's not going to impose a two-state solution, no matter how the vote comes out. It's as you say, it just leaves it. It pushes it. It would perhaps push things to a new stage of negotiations or something. But as we've seen for many decades now, the Israelis and the Americans are very good at stringing along these negotiations without changing the realities on the ground for the Palestinians. So I think the way to look at it is that this is just a little maneuver in the ongoing political struggle, and no sign that struggle is going to conclude anytime soon.
As the year draws to a close, we've been taking a look back at some of the news and events of the past 12 months. One big story in this hemisphere that has received practically no coverage at all in U.S. media is the new canal being built in Nicaragua to connect the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. A year and a half since the Nicaraguan government announced the company that had been chosen to build the waterway, the Chinese HKND Group began construction Monday. The new canal, which is expected to compete favorably with the 100-year-old Panama Canal, will be 167 miles long and between 750 and 1,700 feet wide. Construction is expected to cost $50 billion, with HKND also building an airport, two ports, several highways, a lake, a free trade zone, and a resort as part of the project. On Monday, construction began on the highways leading to the excavation sites. HKND's director, Wang Jin, led an inaugural ceremony in Rivas County, southern Nicaragua. He was joined by the vice president of Nicaragua, Moises Omar Halaslavens, who asserted that Nicaragua intends to move 5% of the products that are shipped through seas globally and to double the country's GDP. We spoke about that and more with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, who began by describing the holiday activities in Nicaragua.
What's the holiday season like there? What's celebrated and how?
Well, in December, and the big celebration is the Immaculate Conception, which is, remember that Nicaragua's, although there are a lot of evangelicals in Nicaragua now, over 50% of the population is still Catholic. So they take very seriously the traditional celebration of the Immaculate Conception that's called here La Purísima. And that's, in some ways, it's an even more important religious feast than Christmas here in Nicaragua. And then the other big religious feast is the Christmas celebration, which is obviously very important in a Catholic country. And the interesting thing is that in Nicaragua, there's so many different local varieties of celebration that the different parts of the country will celebrate those feasts in different ways. And those are the two big events. But in terms of public holidays, the most people, and I think the public workers get 2 weeks off, starting around the 19th, 20th of December. And they then start back early in January. But most other people just take off Christmas Day and New Year's Day. And so there's even though it's a holiday season, there's often an awful lot of activity between Christmas and New Year.
Let me dispel or exorcise some ghosts of the Cold War. So what's not happening there is a bunch of commissars patrolling to make sure no one has any Christmas decorations hanging up so they can command everyone to come to town to hand out packages wrapped in brown paper, you know. That's not the deal.
The dictatorship.
That's not what happens in that Marxist hellhole that you're in.
Well, it never did. I mean, even in the 1980s, the Christmas celebrations were very important.
Of course.
So, yeah, and that's... That's the Christmas season down here, and people generally here in Esteli, where I live, the main industry is are the cigar factories that provide employment to something like 10,000 people out of a population of 170,000,
wow.
Something like that.
That's a big part of the economy. Wow.
Yeah, so and a lot of the cigar factories shut down to do routine annual maintenance, and that gives a lot of people a chance to have a reasonable break over the holiday.
Yes.
So, yeah, and there's all that kind of stuff going on down here over the Christmas holiday, but the big event here in Nicaragua, and something that I'd really like to talk about...
Yeah, the big celebration, is they started the canal, right?
The canal on December the 22nd, but you'd never know it if you read the Western media.
Yeah, let me start with that, actually. I've got, like, one paragraph I want to read here. This is from the left media. This is all that's been reported about the canal... over this, over months as they begin construction. Nicaragua has announced the start of construction for a $50 billion canal project, which has been fiercely opposed by indigenous groups and other local residents. The canal, which is being built by a Hong Kong-based firm, would cut through Nicaragua, connecting the Caribbean Sea and the Pacific Ocean, passing through the region's largest freshwater source. Protesters say it will displace tens of thousands of people and destroy huge swaths of the rainforest. That's it. Now, that's at least reported in the left press, but that's the report, and otherwise nothing.
Yeah, and of course it's so unfair, isn't it? Yeah, let's get back to the canal. So what has that got to do with the canal? Well, it has this to do with the canal. If you read any coverage in the North American or Western European media about the canal, you will get the opposition side of the opposition story of the canal.
Yep.
But you won't get the arguments for the canal. And the arguments for the canal are very simple. The arguments for the canal are that the canal and its associated projects, which are two deep water ports, an international airport, an international manufacturing and commercial zone, a very large modern tourism complex, along with the necessary highway infrastructure and electrical power infrastructure and all the other infrastructure that is needed to do that. The canal and its associated projects will double Nicaragua's GDP, possibly within 6 to 8 years, and certainly within 10 years. And what they'll be able to do with the resources that they generate from that economic activity is eliminate extreme poverty in Nicaragua.
Mm.
Now, that's a fundamental strategic objective that never gets mentioned in the reports.
And it puts them ahead of the United Nations on that score, by the way, doesn't it? The Millennium Goals. They still haven't met the Millennium Goals. This would be for Nicaragua meeting the Millennium Goals.
I'd say them well beyond the Millennium Goals.
Right.
You know, it just leaves the Millennium Goals kind of somewhere in their wake. and so there's that argument. And the other argument against the environment, the superficial, shallow, phony environmentalist arguments against the canal, are that Nicaragua is not a pristine ecological paradise. It's a country that's suffering chronically from deforestation and from contamination and sedimentation of its major water resources, which are Lake Nicaragua and the Rio San Juan. Now, if you listen to the environmentalists, you will find them saying absolutely nothing that in practical terms is going to reverse the chronic deforestation, or that is going to reverse the chronic sedimentation and contamination of Nicaragua's water resources. The argument by the government and the canal's proponents is that with the resources from the canal, which depends on good water management, Nicaragua will be able to reverse its deforestation, reforest large areas of the country that have currently been subject to deforestation, and they'll actually be able to reverse the sedimentation and contamination of Lake Nicaragua and the Rio San Juan. Now, who's right? Are the proponents of the canal right, or are the opponents of the canal right? Well, we don't really know. Time will tell. But there's a genuine argument there, and that argument never happens. That argument never happens because the opponents of the canal deliberately omit Nicaragua's currently dire environmental reality. I recently did an in-depth report on an environmental reserve just not far from where we are in Estelí. And what we found was that there's an extremely complex set of factors that is mitigating against the defense and recovery of that natural reserve that we were investigating. The theme was deforestation and water contamination. And one of the major drivers, not the only driver, but the major driver of that is poverty. So, and what have the environmentalists got to say about poverty? Well, nothing. You know?
Well, you know, again, this
And so when you look at the intellectual production that's coming out of North America and Western Europe about the canal, there they are with their moral superiority saying, oh, we know how the Nicaraguans should deal with their country's environmental problems. And we know best how the Nicaraguans should deal with their chronic economic poverty. But they don't. And they never, never engage directly with the perfectly legitimate arguments of the proponents of the canal and of the Nicaraguan government's arguments about why they think the canal and the canal's associated projects will completely transform Nicaragua's economic and environmental reality very much for the better.
Is it possible to summarize? There was a process, an environmental review. There were studies that were produced by major global engineering firms. And I assume there was also an opportunity for the environmental groups to, post their challenges to the document, and document those challenges. Did that happen?
Well, there's been a constant exchange. And what happened was back in 2012, a Dutch company did a pre-feasibility study to see if the canal was in any way viable or not. And on the basis of that 6-month study that began in December 2012, ended in June 2013, it was decided that the canal was feasible. And then subsequently, there have been 18 months of feasibility studies that are still not finished in terms of the canal itself, in relation to the environment and in relation to fixing the final route to be negotiated with local communities along the way. Local communities, indigenous communities, governing bodies have all been involved in this process for at least a year. But the propaganda that you read in the Western media is that indigenous people's rights are being ridden over roughshod, right, and that they'll be displaced from their land and won't receive compensation. Disgraceful lies. The most disgraceful propagandistic lies. Because the compensation process, the indemnity process, is a very complicated process, and at the moment it's actually causing big problems in the rest of Nicaragua's economy, because so many resources have been devoted from the Attorney General's office that deals with the property issues precisely to trying to resolve the very complicated issues associated with indigenous people's land rights and the land rights of people who whose properties fall in the final route proposed for the canal. And of course, the other issue is that you know what eminent domain is. You're a lawyer, don't you? And so eminent domain is when The national authorities or local authorities say, look, we really need this land. We'll pay you reasonable compensation, and we'll do our best to relocate you. And that's what's happening here in Nicaragua.
That's not what they do here. Say,
it does it anywhere else in the world, you know? Right. So then what happened after those 18 months of feasibility studies was that about a year into them, they'd got advanced enough for the government to be able to announce the likely final route of the canal, but was still with many modifications to be made. And the environmental arguments have been taken into account. For example, there were concerns about some mangrove areas on the Pacific coast, where the deep water port on the Pacific coast is to be built. And so the decision has been taken to move that deep water port inland, 7 kilometres inland, so as not to affect the mangrove swamps. And there are various examples of the way the canal project is being modified to meet environmental concerns. And the other day, Daniel Ortega announced that at their instigation, at the instigation of the Nicaraguan government, the Ramsar United Nations body responsible for wetlands around the world has been invited to come, I think it's in March, to have a look at what the canal project will mean in terms of the wetlands and around a place called San Miguelito in the southeast of Lake Nicaragua. No, and that just shows the good faith of the Nicaraguan government and the HKMD, a main contractor.
You know, I fought a similar project right here in my hometown in New York, and no one invited the United Nations in to supervise it. I think that's quite remarkable all by itself. One last thing, by the way. One thing I have not seen in any media here in the United States yet or anywhere else is something we reported here, which is that the first feasibility study for a canal in Nicaragua was done by the United States in the 1880s.
That's right.
So they've been looking at it a long time.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
I hope you have a good end of the year.
Police in the U.S. should be held accountable in the killings of unarmed young black men, or the killings will continue. That, according to Dr. Vernelia Randall, professor at the University of Dayton, in an interview with Press TV Monday.
No one at any level has actually undertaken any action to make institutional and systemic changes. And since Michael Brown's death, there has been somewhere between 15 and 20 additional young black people killed by police officers in the United States, most of them unarmed.
But Dr. Randall, there are many who say that it's not constitutional or institutional change that is needed. What is needed is a psychological change, where what these protesters are fighting against is the psyche of white America.
That is right, but my experience is, and I was born during Jim Crow, and so I grew up when white people wouldn't, I grew up not being able to go to bathrooms, not being able to eat in restaurants, and the psyche of America was that we couldn't do that. The reason laws do change people's behavior, so what we need is a change in behavior. Part of the problem we have in the United States is that police are not held responsible when they have these deaths. If they were in fact being held responsible, they would begin to check themselves in a way that we want them to check themselves. So they're not being cautious about killing African Americans because there's no penalty to doing it. They will change their psyche when they begin to have a penalty for the death.
So what needs to be done, in your opinion, for this change to be brought about?
Well, I think, first of all, the police department has to say that any police officer that kills a person who is unarmed is on leave without pay, that the investigation is undertaken not by the police department itself, but by some third party, a citizen, that if a prosecution, a special prosecutor will always look at it. We have to have a special prosecutor because the prosecutor and police in the United States are tied together. They depend on each other. So when you ask a prosecutor to prosecute a police officer, you're asking them to look at prosecuting one of their own employees, one of their own arm, necessary component of them getting their job done. So we need the decision on whether or not to prosecute to come by some third party, like retired judges, retired law professors. We need the standard by which police are judged to change.
And today we close with some commentary from imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Demonstrating respect? Throughout much of modern American history, the season of mass demonstrations has been spring and summer. Look at old black and white photos of the anti-war, civil rights, and black power demonstrations of the 1960s and 70s, and you'll see people in t-shirts or simply dressed in shirts and jeans. The dress reflected the ease of the weather. Like in old military theory, the ground or terrain is important when planning battles. Now look at today. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people amass in biting cold, in wind, rain, and even snow. This is thus something new in social movements, perhaps enhanced by social media, but strengthened too by a deep sense that change must come to an intolerable situation. Police violence against unarmed black men and boys. For at the heart of every meaningful movement of the 20th century has been the beating hearts of black people. And let's face it, black people aren't really fond of the cold. This should give us some sense of how deeply these issues resonate in black minds. Now, after the shootings of two cops in New York, come calls from politicians to suspend demos out of respect. The question arises, who respects whom? When cops killed Mike Brown, Eric Garner, and Tamir Rice, who showed respect for them? Brown was literally demonized by his killer. Garner, we were told, was too fat to survive his choking and should have just meekly submitted to the attack on him. Tamir, a child, was big for his age and scared cops, they said. Amazing. According to police bargaining unit head Patrick Lynch, Garner's killer was a model officer, an Eagle Scout, and just doing his job. Yeah, choking a man to death for suspicion of selling a cigarette. Real respectful, huh? Oh, by the way, the verb lynch comes from, we are informed by anti-lynching activist Ida B. Wells, Pittsylvania County, Virginia, around 1780, when a Colonel William Lynch instituted hangings for horse thieves. A crusading journalist, Ida B. Wells, would be amazed at how easily blacks could be killed in the 21st century by police without due process. Her keen eye would survey New York, Cleveland, Ferguson, and beyond, and perhaps she would recognize modern-day lynch law. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.